Welcome to the deep dive. I'm genuinely excited to guide you through a truly vital and often misunderstood area of mental health today. Okay, let's unpack this. We're taking a crucial dive into obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, and its fascinating family of related conditions. For those of you on the front lines of healthcare or diligently preparing to be, and I know many of you listening are aspiring nurses, this deep dive is going to be incredibly valuable. Think of it as your shortcut to truly understanding these complex mental health challenges, equipping you with the nuance to provide not just care, but exceptional care. Our mission, as always, is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge from our sources, articles, research summaries, and comprehensive study guides to help you become genuinely well-informed. To help us ground these concepts, let's imagine a composite patient we'll call Sarah. Sarah is a bright, articulate 28-year-old. On the surface, she manages a demanding job, but internally, she battles a relentless fear that she'll accidentally cause harm to someone if she doesn't perform specific mental rituals perfectly. This often manifests as replaying conversations in her head for hours, checking her door multiple times before leaving, and feeling a pervasive sense of guilt. Her life is consumed by these internal demands, and she's exhausted. We'll explore her journey and others like hers throughout our discussion.
That's an excellent way to frame our deep dive today. What's striking here is just how pervasive and impactful these disorders are, making a deep understanding absolutely essential for anyone in patient care, especially nursing. As you navigate the complexities of mental health, having a crystal clear grasp of these conditions and what they feel like for someone like Sarah will truly empower you to provide effective and compassionate support. Today, we're not just going to list symptoms. We're going on a journey to truly understand what OCD is, how it's diagnosed, its prevalence, and crucially, the essential nursing assessments and management strategies. We'll also explore other related conditions you'll certainly encounter in your practice. Our goal today is to equip you with the knowledge to move beyond just identifying symptoms, to truly providing that compassionate and effective care that makes a difference in a patient's life.
Right. So when we talk about OCD, many people have a certain popular image, maybe someone who meticulously organizes their spice rack or washes their hands frequently. But our sources urge us to get to the clinical truth because the reality is far more distressing and complex. At its core, OCD is defined by two primary components, obsessions and compulsions. Let's truly break these down. Let's start with obsessions. Clinically, our sources define these as excessive, unwanted, intrusive, and persistent thoughts, impulses, or images that cause significant anxiety and distress. The absolute key here is the unwanted and intrusive nature. These aren't just everyday worries or preferences, like fretting about a deadline or wanting your home to be clean. Instead, these are thoughts that invade a person's mind, often feeling foreign, ego-dystonic, meaning they're contrary to one's conscious beliefs and desires, and deeply disturbing.
Exactly. Yeah. What's crucial for future nurses to grasp is that these thoughts aren't chosen. They relentlessly push their way in. Imagine Sarah's experience. She might be plagued by a persistent, intrusive thought that she has accidentally harmed someone, despite knowing logically that she hasn't. Or a different patient might have an overwhelming, unshakable urge that their hands are dirty, even after washing them thoroughly multiple times. Another might have a relentless need for things to be perfectly symmetrical or just right, where any slight misalignment, a book on a shelf, a picture frame, causes extreme discomfort and a pervasive sense of unease. These thoughts create profound distress and anxiety, a kind of mental torment that demands immediate relief, making it incredibly draining to simply exist. The patient often recognizes these thoughts are irrational or exaggerated, yet they cannot dismiss them. That's a critical insight for us to remember in nursing care. The presence of insight doesn't negate the suffering.
So, if obsessions are these relentless internal battles, what do individuals do to try and find relief? That brings us to compulsions. Expert, how do our sources define these behaviors, and how are they directly linked to those distressing obsessions?
If obsessions are the distressing internal thoughts, compulsions are the actions, either external behaviors or mental acts, performed in response. Our sources define compulsions as repeatedly performed behaviors, often in a ritualistic fashion. Their primary goal, and this is the crucial link, is to neutralize or reduce that intense anxiety and distress caused by the obsessions, or to prevent some dreaded event or situation. These aren't random acts. They're often governed by rigid rules or patterns that the individual feels they must follow. Think back to Sarah. Her obsession might be the fear of harming someone. Her compulsion could be a mental ritual, replaying past interactions repeatedly in her head, mentally reviewing every detail, trying to undo or correct any perceived misstep. Or, for a patient with contamination fears, the obsession might be the pervasive thought that they are dirty. The compulsion is excessive hand washing, sometimes to the point of skin damage, dryness, or cracking. or the intrusive thought that one left the stove on or the door unlocked, despite logically knowing it was secured, might lead to repeatedly checking over and over again, sometimes for hours. Avoiding cracks in the pavement or repeating phrases a certain number of times are other examples. These behaviors provide a temporary, almost illusory, sense of control and relief from the anxiety. But it's fleeting. The obsessive thought almost inevitably returns, restarting that distressing, self-perpetuating cycle. Our sources make it unequivocally clear. Obsessiveness, those intrusive thoughts, coupled with compulsions, the ritualistic behaviors are what define OCD. It's a cruel loop.
So it's profoundly different from simply being neat and tidy or having a strong preference for order. It's a relentless internal battle that demands a specific response, often one that takes over a person's life and causes immense suffering. This isn't a choice. It's a deeply ingrained pattern that causes profound distress. And here's where we get to a crucial insight for nursing students. Many people, including some healthcare professionals, might assume that because someone with OCD recognizes their thoughts are irrational, they should simply be able to stop. But the reality, as our sources highlight, is that this insight paradox is central to the suffering. The patient knows it's illogical, yet the urge to perform the compulsion is overwhelmingly powerful. This distinction makes empathy absolutely crucial and sets OCD apart from conditions like psychosis, where insight is often absent. Understanding this paradox is vital for genuine, compassionate care.
Absolutely. And that leads us nicely into the diagnostic side of things. Now that we understand the core components, the obsessions and the compulsions, the next critical step for clinicians, and particularly for future nurses like yourselves, is to definitively identify OCD using established diagnostic criteria. It's not enough to simply observe a repetitive behavior. There are specific criteria that must be met to confirm the diagnosis and ensure appropriate treatment. First, and as you might expect, there must be the presence of obsessions or compulsions. This is the fundamental baseline. You need to identify clear evidence of these intrusive, unwanted thoughts, those mental battles, or the ritualistic behaviors that follow them. However, it's essential to understand that simply having these doesn't automatically mean an OCD diagnosis. Many people have occasional intrusive thoughts or routine-like behaviors. The criteria go deeper. Second, and this is a truly crucial point for nursing assessment, is patient recognition. As we just discussed, the individual with OCD typically recognizes that their obsessions or compulsions are unreasonable or excessive. What's particularly insightful here for nurses is that this isn't a sign of weakness. It's a symptom. Unlike some other mental health conditions where a patient might lack insight into their condition, individuals with OCD often know that their behaviors are illogical or disproportionate, yet they feel utterly powerless to stop them. They might even feel embarrassed or ashamed, trying to hide their rituals. This is vital because it tells us it's not a delusion or a psychotic break. They aren't losing touch with reality. This preserved insight, ironically, can be a valuable starting point for therapeutic interventions, as it means the patient can engage in understanding their condition.
Okay, so they have the obsessions or compulsions, and they usually know it's excessive. What's the next piece of the diagnostic puzzle?
The next piece is critical. These obsessions and compulsions must cause significant disturbance in daily functioning. This isn't just a minor annoyance. It profoundly impacts their ability to live a normal life. Our sources emphasize that this means they severely disrupt daily routines, impair relationships, or negatively impact occupational or academic function. Think back to Sarah, constantly replaying conversations to ensure she hasn't caused harm. This takes up immense mental energy and time. A key quantifiable marker, specifically highlighted in our diagnostic sources, is that these thoughts and rituals are time-consuming, taking longer than 1 hour a day to complete. That specific detail, that one-hour threshold, is a vital diagnostic marker.
That one-hour threshold sounds incredibly impactful. If I'm a new nurse, how can I really assess this in a patient like Sarah? And what does it mean for us clinically if someone is spending more than an hour a day on these rituals? Is there a common pitfall in differentiating this from other anxiety disorders?
That's a fantastic, practical question. For nurses, assessing that one-hour threshold involves direct questioning, but also keen observation and listening to the patient's narrative. You might ask, can you describe a typical day for me? How much time would you estimate do these thoughts or actions take away from your daily activities? Or do you ever feel like you're stuck performing a ritual, and how long does that typically last? The patient might describe getting up 2 hours early just to complete their checking rituals before work, or spending their entire evening washing, or unable to leave the house due to intrusive thoughts. This isn't just about diagnosis. It often signals the point where the disorder begins to catastrophically disrupt their life, their job, their relationships, their self-care. It moves from being an issue to a profound disability. Regarding differentiation, it's a common challenge. The key is the nature of the thoughts and behaviors. For generalized anxiety disorder, for example, worries are usually about real-life concerns, finances, health, family, and while excessive, aren't typically intrusive, unwanted, or ego-dystonic in the same way obsessions are. The person identifies with their worries. In OCD, the thoughts are often bizarre or unacceptable to the individual, like Sarah's fear of causing harm. Compulsions, too, are distinct. They are ritualistic attempts to neutralize the obsession, which isn't typically seen in other anxiety disorders. For instance, repeatedly checking the oven for safety, OCD compulsion, is different from generally worrying about house safety, GAD.
Right, that distinction is really important. So, functional impairment, insight. What else?
Finally, we have the exclusion criteria. It's critical to rule out other causes. The thoughts or behaviors must not be a direct physiological effect of a substance, such as drug abuse or medication side effects, nor attributable to another medical condition. For example, ruling out a neurological condition that might cause repetitive movements. And critically, they must not be better explained by another mental disorder, such as another anxiety disorder, a psychotic disorder, or even body dysmorphic disorder, which we'll discuss later, as it has its own distinct diagnostic category, even though it's related. This highlights why a thorough assessment going beyond just presenting symptoms is absolutely vital. Our ability to differentiate these criteria clearly ensures the patient gets the right diagnosis, the most appropriate support, and a treatment plan that targets their specific needs, avoiding misdiagnosis that could delay effective care.
Okay, that makes sense. So understanding the what and how of diagnosis leads us directly to the who and when. How prevalent is OCD in the general population, and what does its journey typically look like over a person's life? These are important questions for anyone in healthcare to grasp, giving us context for the scale of this challenge. Let's talk about prevalence. Our sources consistently indicate a lifetime prevalence of OCD in approximately 1.2% of the general population. While that percentage might seem modest, when you consider the global population, it means millions of people are living with this condition worldwide. And for many of you who might work in pediatrics or adolescent mental health, it's even more relevant. OCD affects between 1% and 3% or more of children and adolescents. These numbers clearly show it's a significant condition that nurses will definitely encounter across various settings, from pediatric and school health clinics to adult mental health units, and even general medical floors where comorbid conditions may exist. It's not a rare diagnosis.
Definitely not rare. And this leads us to the onset and course of the disorder, which is crucial for patient education and setting expectations. OCD typically has an onset in the early 20s to mid-30s. However, what's particularly insightful for nursing assessment is that symptoms very often begin in childhood or adolescence. This suggests that for many individuals, OCD is not a new challenge that suddenly appears in adulthood, but a long-standing issue that may have gone undiagnosed, misunderstood, or misattributed for years. Think of Sarah, who might recall subtle fears or rituals beginning in her preteen years that escalated over time. The symptom onset is usually gradual, not sudden. This gradual progression can make early detection challenging, as initial behaviors might be dismissed as phases, quirks, or perfectionism before they escalate to a debilitating level. This slow creep often means years of suffering before a diagnosis is made, which can lead to significant life disruptions. And critically, our sources emphasize that OCD is generally considered a lifelong illness, requiring ongoing management and support, even if symptoms wax and wane. It's not something that typically just disappears. It requires consistent, proactive care.
So understanding that gradual onset and lifelong nature is key for how we approach care. And are there any notable gender differences?
Yes, there are slight differences. Females are affected slightly more than males in adulthood. However, in childhood, males are actually affected more commonly than females, which then often evens out or slightly reverses in adulthood. This subtle shift is another piece of demographic detail that helps us understand the landscape of the disorder.
So what does this all mean for patient education and, importantly, long-term care from a nursing perspective? If it's a marathon, not a sprint, how do nurses help patients prepare for that journey and avoid burnout?
That's a critical point. Knowing it's a lifelong illness means we must emphasize ongoing management rather than a cure. For patients and their families, this means early, thorough psychoeducation becomes paramount. Nurses are instrumental in helping patients understand that this is not a personal failing, but a recognized medical condition requiring sustained strategies. We help them recognize triggers, develop robust coping mechanisms, and understand the importance of medication adherence and continued therapy. Avoiding burnout for patients and caregivers means fostering self-compassion, building strong support networks, and integrating self-care into the treatment plan, not as an afterthought. It's about empowering them with the tools for sustained resilience, letting them know that while the path is long, they are not alone.
That emphasis on empowerment and long-term resilience is so important. Now, beyond the observable symptoms and the diagnostic criteria, our sources highlight a significant biological basis at play with OCD. Expert, if we connect this to the bigger picture, understanding the underlying why behind OCD is crucial not only for scientific curiosity, but also for explaining treatment rationales to patients like Sarah and their families. It demystifies the condition. What do we know about its biological underpinnings?
Absolutely. Understanding the why provides immense relief and validation for patients, shifting the narrative from a moral failing to a medical condition. The pathophysiology of OCD is considered multifaceted, involving a complex interplay of several factors. First, there's a clear genetic predisposition. Our sources highlight an increased likelihood of developing OCD due to inherited genes. This isn't a simple OCD gene, but rather a heightened genetic vulnerability. This means that if there's a family history of OCD, or even other anxiety or anodic disorders, an individual may be more prone to developing it themselves. This implication is important for nursing assessments, as asking about family history can provide valuable context and help identify at-risk individuals. It signals a biological susceptibility, not a direct cause.
So genetics plays a role, a predisposition. What else?
Secondly, we look at neuropathology. This refers to structural or functional abnormalities in specific brain regions. Neuropathology is essentially the study of diseases affecting nervous system tissue. Research strongly implicates certain neural circuits in OCD, particularly the corticostriatal thalamocortical or CSTC loops. These are pathways connecting the cortex, involved in thought and decision-making, the striatum, involved in habit formation and reward, and the thalamus, a relay station for sensory and motor signals. In OCD, there appears to be an overactivity in these circuits, leading to a kind of brain lock, where thoughts and behaviors get stuck in repetitive loops. This explains why patients struggle so intensely with thought stopping and response prevention. Their brain is physically wired to get stuck. For nurses, understanding this helps explain why willpower alone isn't enough. There's a tangible biological component.
A brain lock, that's a powerful image. And what about the brain chemistry itself?
Exactly. Thirdly, there are biochemical imbalances, specifically disruptions in neurochemicals within the brain. Our sources specifically implicate serotonin and norepinephrine as key neurotransmitters often involved. Serotonin in particular is a well-known player in mood, anxiety, and impulse control regulation. When serotonin levels or receptor activity are imbalanced, it can contribute to the severity and persistence of obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviors. Norepinephrine, involved in stress and arousal, also plays a role in the heightened anxiety. Some research also points to the involvement of dopamine pathways. The relevance of this understanding for nursing is immense because it directly informs pharmacological interventions. Many of the medications used to treat OCD, which we'll discuss shortly, primarily target these very neurotransmitter systems, aiming to restore a healthier chemical balance.
So understanding these genetic, structural, and biochemical factors paints a much clearer picture. For nurses, how does this scientific understanding translate into practical patient education? How do we explain these complex biological underpinnings to a patient like Sarah, who might be feeling immense shame or confusion about her condition in a way that truly empowers her?
That's a vital question. As nurses, our role is to act as bridge builders between complex science and patient understanding. When explaining these biological factors to Sarah, you would emphasize that OCD is a brain-based disorder, not a character flaw. You might say something like, "Sarah, your brain's natural alarm system, which normally keeps you safe, seems to be a little overactive right now." We know from research that certain chemical messengers in the brain, like serotonin and specific brain circuits, are not quite in balance for people with OCD. This means the thoughts you're having are not your fault. They're a result of these biological processes, much like diabetes is a result of an insulin imbalance. Our treatments, whether medication or therapy, are designed to help re-regulate these brain systems, not to fix a moral failing. This reframe is incredibly powerful. It alleviates guilt, fosters hope, and provides a clear rationale for treatment. It helps them understand that adhering to medication, for example, isn't about giving in, but about restoring a physiological balance. It's about empathetic communication that validates their experience while educating them about the scientific basis of their condition.
That reframing is so essential for building trust and therapeutic alliance. Okay, now, let's bring it back directly to your role as a nurse. When a patient like Sarah presents with potential OCD, what are the priority areas you need to assess? A holistic approach is absolutely essential here, looking beyond just the mental symptoms to understand the full, pervasive impact of the disorder on the individual. Where do we even begin?
That's where the nurse's keen eye and comprehensive approach truly shine. First up is the physical assessment. While OCD is fundamentally a mental health disorder, its chronic nature and the specific compulsions can manifest with multiple, often overlooked physical symptoms. As nurses, you need to be particularly vigilant. You might observe general signs of chronic stress and anxiety fatigue, muscle tension, gastrointestinal issues, but more specifically, keep an eye out for dermatologic lesions. This is crucial due to repetitive behaviors like excessive washing, scrubbing, picking at skin, or prolonged contact with hard cleaning agents, which can lead to irritation, severe dryness, cracking, open sores, or even secondary infections. Imagine a patient who washes their hands 50 times a day. Their skin will tell a story of constant trauma. Our sources even give us a perfect illustrative scenario. A patient with OCD has a fear of contamination. Which nursing diagnosis would be a priority? Impaired skin integrity. This directly highlights how physical symptoms demand our attention.
Impaired skin integrity, that's a really concrete example. Mm-hmm. Are there other physical impacts nurses should be aware of?
Yes. Another potential, though perhaps less obvious physical consequence mentioned in our sources, is osteoarthritis joint damage, which can result from repetitive, ritualistic movements performed over long periods. Think about someone who repeatedly checks locks, taps surfaces, or performs complex motor rituals for hours each day over time. This can take a significant toll on their joints, leading to pain and reduced mobility. Your physical assessment should inquire about any chronic pain, stiffness, or functional limitations they might be experiencing. These physical manifestations can severely impact quality of life and require direct nursing intervention.
So, beyond the visible physical signs, what about the internal world of the patient? How do we effectively assess the mental and emotional toll these obsessions and compulsions are taking on someone like Sarah?
Excellent question, because that's where the heart of their suffering often lies. Moving on to the mental assessment, your focus should be on the degree of symptom interference. How much do the obsessions and compulsions disrupt their daily function? This connects directly back to our diagnostic criteria. Are they consuming more than an hour a day? Are they interfering with their work, studies, ability to care for themselves, or participate in meaningful activities? You might use standardized screening tools, but also open-ended questions like, tell me about a typical day. What are the biggest challenges you face because of these thoughts or behaviors? Or, if you could wave a magic wand, what part of your daily life would you most want to change? You also want to assess their quality of life. This involves exploring their subjective experience of distress, their feelings of hopelessness, their level of anxiety, and how much control they feel they have over their thoughts and actions. Are they feeling depressed due to the relentless nature of the illness? Are they experiencing suicidal ideation because of the overwhelming burden? These are critical areas for direct inquiry. Understanding their internal suffering is key to empathetic and effective care planning.
And finally, the social aspect often gets overlooked in mental health, but it's so critical. How do nurses conduct a thorough social assessment for a patient with OCD? What specific signs of isolation or relationship impact should we be looking for in someone like Sarah?
The social assessment is indeed profound and often reveals the hidden costs of OCD. You want to explore sociocultural factors, how their environment, cultural background, or support system might influence their experience of OCD. Some cultures might stigmatize mental illness more, leading to delayed help seeking. Crucially, you'll assess their ability to relate to others. The intense distress, time-consuming rituals, and often hidden nature of OCD can lead to significant social isolation. Patients might avoid social situations where their compulsions could be triggered or exposed. For Sarah, her constant mental checking and guilt might make her withdrawn or hesitant to engage deeply with others for fear of contamination or causing offense. Look for cues like, has their social circle shrunk? Are they avoiding work events, family gatherings, or public places? Do they report difficulties in intimate relationships? Are they able to maintain friendships? This can often lead to a diminished social life, loneliness, and further exacerbate feelings of depression or anxiety. A thorough social assessment helps identify these crucial support gaps and informs interventions aimed at reintegrating the patient into their social world. This comprehensive assessment isn't just about ticking boxes. It's about seeing the whole person and understanding the profound, pervasive impact this disorder has across their entire life, physically, mentally, and socially. This allows you to tailor your care to their specific individual needs, making you an invaluable part of their care team.
That holistic view, physical, mental, social, is so crucial. Okay, so once that thorough assessment is done, the critical step is moving into management. Expert, if we connect this to the bigger picture for nursing students, what are the practical, evidence-based strategies we employ to help patients with OCD? It sounds like it needs a really multifaceted approach.
It absolutely does. It involves direct physical care, pharmacological support, and extensive patient education, where nurses play a truly frontline role. First, stemming directly from our assessment findings is skin integrity maintenance. This is a priority because of the direct dermatologic issues that often arise from compulsive washing, picking, or other repetitive skin-related behaviors. As a nurse, your actions would include educating patients on gentle skin care, recommending fragrance-free moisturizers to prevent dryness and cracking, diligently monitoring for any signs of infection and lesions, redness, warmth, pus, and helping them understand ways to prevent further damage. This might involve recommending gloves for specific chores if hand washing is excessive or discussing gentle cleansers. It's about managing the immediate physical consequences, which can be both painful and a source of further distress.
Makes sense. Address the immediate physical harm. What's next?
Second, psychopharmacology plays a significant role. Medications help manage the biochemical imbalances we discussed earlier, aiming to reduce the severity of symptoms. The key medications often used for OCD are a class of antidepressants, specifically selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs. Our sources specifically name clomipramine, sertraline, fluvoxamine, and venlafaxine as commonly prescribed. These medications work by increasing the availability of serotonin and norepinephrine for SNRIs in the brain, helping to regulate those overactive neural circuits.
Okay, so SSRIs and SNRIs are the mainstays. What's the nurse's specific role with these meds?
As a nurse, your role is crucial here. You'll be administering these medications, meticulously monitoring for any side effects, which can range from gastrointestinal upset to sexual dysfunction or agitation, and perhaps most importantly, educating patients on the importance of adherence. You'll explain that these medications often take several weeks to reach therapeutic effect, so patience and consistency are key. You'll also need to set realistic expectations, explaining that improvement is often gradual and that these medications work best when combined with other therapeutic strategies, particularly behavioral therapies. Never promise a cure, but emphasize significant symptom reduction and improved quality of life.
That's incredibly important. And here's where it gets really impactful for the patient and where nursing education becomes absolutely paramount: behavioral and cognitive strategies. Expert nurses are uniquely positioned to teach and support patients in implementing these crucial interventions. Can you walk us through some of the most effective ones and how a nurse would practically apply them with someone like Sarah?
This is where nurses truly empower patients. These strategies are not just for therapists. Nurses, through patient education and support, facilitate their success. One of the most effective behavioral therapies, often facilitated by nurses, is response prevention. This is a technique where individuals learn to resist performing their compulsive rituals after experiencing an obsession. The goal is to gradually reduce the link between the obsession and the compulsive behavior, thereby decreasing anxiety over time as they learn that the feared outcome doesn't materialize. For Sarah, who mentally replays conversations for fear of causing harm, response prevention would involve guiding her to not engage in that mental review, allowing the anxiety to rise and then naturally dissipate without the ritual. A nurse might say, "Sarah, let's try just for 5 minutes to let that thought be there, but resist the urge to replay. We'll be here and we'll track how your anxiety changes." Your nursing role here is to guide patients through this incredibly challenging process, providing immense support, encouragement, and reassurance that the anxiety will eventually decrease. It's about building their tolerance for distress.
Wow, so response prevention is really about facing the fear head on without the usual safety behavior. That sounds tough, but powerful. What else?
It is tough, but incredibly effective. Then there's thought stopping. This is a cognitive behavioral technique used to interrupt obsessive or unwanted thoughts by mentally or physically saying stop. The idea is to break the cycle of rumination. As a nurse, you would teach the patient this technique and help them practice it. You might instruct Sarah to, as soon as an unwanted thought intrudes, mentally shout "stop" in her mind, or even subtly snap a rubber band on her wrist. You could practice by saying, "Okay, Sarah, when that harm thought comes, I want you to immediately say stop to yourself. What does that feel like? Did it interrupt the thought?" It's a way to regain a momentary sense of control over intrusive thoughts, creating a brief window to redirect attention.
Okay, so interrupting the thought pattern. And are there ways to manage the underlying anxiety that fuels it all?
Yes, absolutely. Relaxation techniques are also vital. These include practices like deep breathing exercises, progressive muscle relaxation, or meditation. Their goal is to reduce anxiety and stress, providing the patient with alternative, healthy coping mechanisms to manage the distress triggered by obsessions. Your role would be to teach and facilitate these techniques, helping patients find what works best for them to calm their nervous system. You might guide Sarah through a 5-minute deep breathing exercise when she feels overwhelmed, saying, "Let's focus on your breath, Sarah. Inhale slowly for 4 counts, hold for 7, exhale for 8. This helps activate your parasympathetic nervous system, your body's natural calming response.
Breathing techniques. Simple but effective. What about changing the thoughts themselves?
That's where cognitive restructuring comes in. It's another powerful CBT technique. It helps individuals identify and challenge distorted or irrational thoughts associated with their obsessions and then replace them with more realistic and balanced ones. For example, if Sarah believes, "If I don't mentally replay that conversation, I will definitely cause harm," cognitive restructuring helps her challenge that absolute catastrophic belief. A nurse could assist Sarah in identifying these problematic thought patterns by asking, "What's the evidence that not replaying the conversation automatically leads to harm? Has that ever happened before? What's a more balanced way to think about this?" And guiding her toward healthier, more rational perspectives.
Challenging those core beliefs. And are there any sort of practical tools nurses can help patients create?
Yes, definitely. We also have practical tools like cue cards. These are small cards with coping statements, reminders, or steps to follow during an anxious or obsessive episode. Imagine a card for Sarah that says, "My thoughts are not commands. I am safe. I have checked once. That is enough. This feeling will pass." Your role as a nurse is to help patients create these personalized cue cards, empowering them with accessible reminders during moments of distress, which they can carry in their pocket or keep at their desk. And finally, a psychoeducation checklist plan. This is a structured, step-by-step guide on what to do if the cycle starts or if the urge to start a compulsion arises. It's a concrete plan for the patient to follow, giving them a sense of control and agency during overwhelming moments. As a nurse, you would collaborate with the patient to develop and refine this personalized plan. For Sarah, it might be 1, recognize the intrusive thought. 2, say "stop" to yourself. 3, look at your cue card. 4, engage in 5 minutes of deep breathing. 5, distract with a pre-planned activity. It's about building a robust, personalized toolkit.
These educational strategies are profoundly about empowering the patient, giving them tangible tools to manage their illness and break the cycle of distress. It's truly a collaborative effort between the patient, their therapist, and the nursing team. By teaching these skills, nurses provide not just relief from symptoms, but a pathway to long-term coping and improved quality of life. It moves us beyond just treating symptoms to teaching resilience. Now, OCD doesn't exist in a vacuum. Our sources highlight a fascinating and important family of related disorders that share some common threads of repetitive behaviors and intrusive thoughts, but they each have distinct presentations and challenges. Let's make sure you're thoroughly familiar with these two, as you'll absolutely encounter them in your clinical practice. Recognizing their unique nuances is crucial.
Absolutely. Differentiating these conditions is key to providing targeted care. Let's start with trichotillomania disorder, often called hair pulling disorder. Its key characteristic is chronic, recurrent pulling out of one's own hair, which results in noticeable hair loss. This isn't just a nervous habit. It's a compulsive, body-focused, repetitive behavior that leads to significant patches of baldness, often on the scalp, eyebrows, or eyelashes. It often has an early onset, sometimes in children as young as age 5, and affects about 1-2% of the population.
Hair pulling, what usually triggers that?
Our sources point to a range of emotional states and environmental factors. Stress, trauma, anxiety, loneliness, anger, frustration, and even boredom or moments of intense concentration. For nursing assessment, you'd look for patchy bald areas, different hair lengths in the affected spots, and patients might report a growing tension relieved by pulling. For management, the crucial nursing intervention is to find the trigger to prevent. This involves helping the patient identify those underlying stressors or emotional states, and then developing alternative coping mechanisms such as fidget toys, stress reduction techniques, or habit reversal training. Skin integrity of the scalp also becomes a nursing priority, monitoring for irritation or infection.
Okay, finding the trigger. What about skin picking? Is that similar?
Yes. Next up is excoriation disorder, more commonly known as skin picking disorder. Like trichotillomania, its key characteristic is recurrent skin picking that results in skin lesions and causes significant distress or impairment. This isn't just occasional picking at a scab. It's persistent, often unconscious, and can lead to open wounds, scabs, infections, and scarring across various body areas. Its prevalence varies from 1.4% to 5.4% of the population. Like hair pulling, it's often triggered by anxiety, stress, or boredom. Interventions for excoriation disorder typically involve both behavioral and pharmacologic approaches, very similar to OCD, often using SSRIs. As nurses, your focus will be akin to OCD management, a priority assessment of skin integrity, diligent monitoring for infection and preventing further damage, and crucial patient education in identifying and avoiding their picking triggers. Habit reversal training is also a primary behavioral therapy. You'd also consider the psychosocial impact, as patients often feel shame and try to hide lesions.
These body-focused repetitive behaviors truly highlight the diverse ways anxiety can manifest. But what about conditions that deal with self-perception rather than direct physical actions like pulling or picking?
That brings us to body dysmorphic disorder, BDD. This is a fascinating and often debilitating condition where the key characteristic is a preoccupation with a perceived defect in physical appearance that is either slight or imagined by others. Individuals with BDD literally see imperfections that aren't really there, or they wildly exaggerate minor flaws, considering them serious defects. Our sources sum it up powerfully. They are obsessed with the way they look constantly. This isn't vanity or simply wanting to look good. It's a profound, distressing, and often delusional conviction that their appearance is hideously flawed, leading to repetitive behaviors like excessive mirror checking, camouflaging, e.g. wearing heavy makeup, specific clothing, seeking reassurance, or comparing themselves to others.
Wow, obsessed constantly. How common is BDD, and what's the primary treatment?
It affects about 1 in 50 people, and there's a significant comorbidity. With 60% of individuals with BDD also having an anxiety disorder, and often depression. The primary treatment for BDD is cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, specifically tailored to challenge those distorted thought patterns and reduce compulsive behaviors. For nurses, understanding the subjective distress is very real and profound, regardless of what objective appearance might suggest. Their suffering is genuine, and dismissing their concerns about appearance only invalidates their experience. Assessment would involve asking about their specific preoccupations, how much time they spend on them, and what rituals they perform to fix or hide their perceived defect.
That's a crucial distinction, the realness of their subjective suffering. And finally, a condition that many people have heard of but perhaps don't fully understand the compulsive nature of it, hoarding disorder.
Yes, hoarding disorder is another important member of this family. The key characteristic here is a persistent difficulty parting with or discarding possessions, regardless of their actual value, leading to an accumulation that clutters living areas to the point of potentially rendering them unusable or unsafe. This isn't just being a collector or having a messy house. It's an inability to let go of items, driven by a perceived need to save them and distress at the thought of discarding them. This leads to extremely cluttered, often unsanitary, and sometimes dangerous living conditions.
So it's the difficulty discarding leading to clutter? How prevalent is hoarding?
It affects 2% to 6% of the population and may even start in childhood, gradually worsening over decades. Interventions involve both behavioral and pharmacologic approaches, especially for co-occurring mental disorders like anxiety or depression, which are very common. Your nursing role here would be multifaceted. Understanding the deep psychological challenges patients face in discarding items, compassionately assessing safety risks in the home environment, fire hazards, sanitation issues, fall risks, and supporting the therapeutic interventions aimed at helping patients manage their accumulation and organize their space. This often involves working with a multidisciplinary team, including social workers and occupational therapists, due to the complexity of the problem. If we connect this to the bigger picture for you as future nurses, recognizing the nuances between these conditions is absolutely critical. While they all share some obsessive-compulsive traits, particularly the repetitive behaviors and distressing thoughts, their specific presentations, the core preoccupations, and primary treatment avenues can differ significantly. This requires a tailored approach from the care team. Your ability to differentiate these conditions will ensure that patients like Sarah or others you encounter receive the most appropriate and effective support, whether it's focused on hair pulling, skin picking, body image concerns, or the complex challenges of hoarding behaviors.
Recognizing those nuances for tailored care. That's key. So looking across all these conditions, OCD, trichotillomania, excoriation, BDD, hoarding, are there some overarching principles that guide effective treatment and nursing support?
Yes, absolutely. Across all these conditions, there are some fundamental overarching principles that guide effective treatment and nursing support. These are essential for any healthcare professional to integrate into their practice. First and foremost, we must identify triggers. This is crucial for both behavioral and pharmacological interventions, whether it's stress, specific environments, certain thoughts, or emotional states for Sarah, it might be feelings of inadequacy or uncertainty. Understanding what initiates the obsessions or the urge to perform compulsions is the absolute first step in breaking the cycle. As nurses, we play a vital role in helping patients recognize and articulate these triggers through careful assessment and ongoing dialogue. Without this, interventions are far less effective.
Identify triggers. Got it. What else?
Second, the goal is always to develop coping strategies. We need to equip patients with effective tools to manage their distress and interrupt the cycle of their symptoms. This involves teaching them the techniques we discussed earlier, such as response prevention, thought stopping, relaxation, and cognitive restructuring, and empowering them to integrate these into their daily lives. The more robust and personalized their toolkit, the better equipped they are to navigate challenging moments.
Coping strategies. Okay, and how does treatment come together?
Third, it's imperative to implement a comprehensive treatment plan. This means a multimodal approach combining evidence-based psychotherapy, especially cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and exposure and response prevention, ERP, with appropriate medication, and critically robust nursing interventions that reinforce therapy and support daily living. No single treatment works in isolation. A coordinated interdisciplinary effort provides the best and most sustainable outcomes.
A team approach. And what about the long haul?
Finally, and perhaps most importantly, we must acknowledge the need for ongoing management and support. Many of these conditions, especially OCD, are generally lifelong illnesses. This means that continuous care, regular monitoring of symptoms, and adjustments to treatment plans are often necessary. It's about providing consistent support to help patients navigate the ups and downs of their journey, prevent relapses, and maintain their quality of life over the long term.
That's a powerful and realistic perspective, expert. So for a nurse in a busy clinical setting, what are the most significant challenges in ensuring that this crucial long-term support actually happens rather than just being a recommendation on a discharge sheet? And how do we involve families and leverage community resources effectively for patients like Sarah?
That's a very practical challenge, and it really highlights the nurse's role as an advocate and coordinator. One significant challenge is the episodic nature of healthcare. Patients might be seen during an acute crisis, but continuity of care for chronic conditions like OCD can be fragmented. Nurses are vital in patient advocacy and care coordination. This means actively connecting patients with outpatient therapists, specializing in ERP, ensuring they have follow-up appointments scheduled before discharge, and educating them about the importance of consistent engagement. We also need to help them understand medication management, including side effects, and reinforcing adherence. Family involvement is paramount, but it requires delicate navigation. Family members often experience distress themselves and can sometimes unwittingly accommodate rituals, which can perpetuate the disorder. Nurses can educate families about the inside paradox, help them understand how to support without enabling compulsions, and teach them communication strategies. For Sarah, involving her family could mean helping them understand that her repeated questions about safety aren't just for reassurance, but part of a compulsion, and guiding them on how to respond in a way that helps break the cycle rather than feeding it.
That family education piece sounds critical. And community resources.
Finally, leveraging community resources is essential. This includes support groups, online forums for patients and families, and local mental health organizations. Nurses can provide lists of these resources, explain their benefits, and even assist patients in making initial contact. It's about building a robust support ecosystem around the patient, recognizing that our role extends beyond the immediate clinical encounter to empowering them within their broader community for sustained wellness. This raises an important question. How can nurses best advocate for and support patients through these long-term journeys, ensuring they feel heard, understood, and empowered to live fulfilling lives despite their diagnosis, integrating all these elements into a seamless web of care?
So what does this all mean for you? We've taken a truly comprehensive deep dive into obsessive-compulsive disorder and its related conditions, covering everything from the precise definitions of obsessions and compulsions and their often misunderstood diagnostic criteria, to crucial nursing assessments, the underlying pathophysiology, and a wide array of practical, actionable nursing interventions. For you, as nursing students, you now have a robust understanding of these complex mental health challenges, equipping you to better serve your future patients, patients like Sarah, with empathy, evidence-based care, and a truly holistic perspective that extends beyond the immediate symptoms to their entire life journey.
What's truly impactful here is how much power lies in your understanding. For you, as future nurses, this knowledge isn't just theoretical. It translates directly into better patient outcomes, reducing profound distress, and demonstrably improving quality of life. by recognizing the intricate interplay of biological, psychological, and social factors, and by mastering the assessment and management strategies we've discussed today, you become incredibly effective advocates and caregivers. This raises an important question for you to ponder and carry into your practice. How will your refined understanding of the deep-seated anxiety and profound, often hidden, impact of these disorders shape your initial interactions and long-term care plans for these patients, fostering not just treatment, but true holistic support, respect for their journey, and ultimately, hope?
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep learning, keep questioning, and keep making a profound difference in the lives of your patients.